From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
Thank you, Lynn. Kirk Heinze broadcasts Greening of the Great Lakes from the Michigan Environmental Council's 18th Annual Environmental Awards Ceremony and talks with MSU's renowned Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, among others. And I'll talk with MSU alumnus Peter Carey, who will play Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's Ernie, coming to Wharton Center August 24th through the 27th. MSU Today begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, we're in downtown Ann Arbor at the Michigan Environmental Council's 18th Annual Environmental Awards presentation, this year honoring the achievements of two outstanding environmental leaders. And with us to set the stage for tonight's celebration is Chris Kolb. Chris is president of the Michigan Environmental Council. Quite an evening, Chris.
It's a great evening, and this is, as you said, our 18th annual award celebration, and it's just that. It's a celebration, and it's a night where we celebrate two honorees, one with the Petoskey Prize, which is our prize that are individuals who are nominated by our member groups, and it is a volunteer, someone who's not paid, and they must go above and beyond that super volunteer that all organizations have to have. And then we also have the Helen and William Milliken Award, and that's an award that goes to an environmental leader who's actually sort of a professional, someone who's paid to do that. And we look for people who really have done things over a lifespan or something really extraordinary. And tonight we've got really two great people that we're honoring.
Well, we're going to talk to those people in the next couple of segments, but just give us a snapshot of Dr. Mona and Pam.
Sure. Well, let's, I think everyone knows Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha from Flint, who really, what I was really impressed with by her was that she was the voice that finally got the state to admit that there was something wrong. And it was because she did her homework. She did the analysis. It showed that blood levels in children in Flint were actually 2 to 3 times higher after they switched the drinking water source to the Flint River than before. The state had denied and said nothing was wrong. They said, we looked at the analysis. There isn't a problem. She doubled and triple-checked her analysis. It was plain as day, and she stuck to her guns, and eventually the state said, yep, you're right. And she didn't just stop there. She could have said, you know what, that's fine. No, she's launched herself into this. She's continuing to work every day to make sure that the children of Flint, the Flint community, it heals from this process. And there's no one better this year to honor with the Milliken Award than Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. And then we'll go to our Petoskey Prize winner, Pam Taylor. Pam, this is actually sort of, there's always a theme. People don't always see the theme, but this year the theme really was water, and Pam Taylor's done a lot of work as a volunteer down in South Central and Southeast Michigan, really looking at water quality, and where they're concerned is that there's a lot of CAFOs, confined animal feedlots, and you have thousands and thousands of head of cattle in a very confined space, produces a lot of manure. We have to get rid of that manure, and they spray it on our agricultural fields. And often that manure actually runs off those fields, goes into the drains, into the streams, and eventually into Lake Erie. And 2 years ago, on August 2nd, 2014, the citizens in the Toledo area woke up with the message, do not drink your water, do not use it, don't bathe in it, don't cook with it, because we have had a contamination. That was from the toxic algae bloom in Lake Erie. We've had that bloom before, but it's never gotten into the intake of the Toledo water source, but it did. And when it did, people said, well, there's a lot of reasons for it, but really, we don't believe that manure and agricultural runoff is a problem. Well, that didn't really, make sense to Pam, and she really, they went back and started to look at the data, and they found, well, one, we don't really have any data. So they really went back and really looked at how many farms there were, how many cattle head there were. They went back and looked at the water quality data, and they created this huge database. And at one time, they were told that there was only like, you know, about 10,000 or so, you know, cattle head in the area. Well, there's actually like 11 million. And there's this huge number of cattle in that water basin, and they are, you know, causing a problem when there's a heavy rain and the spring thaw. And so it really is an issue. So she's been able to, through her research, create this database to really get the state to focus in on this issue. And that's why we're really honoring her. She puts in over 40 hours a week on a volunteer basis doing this, of going out and doing the water quality check, taking photos when there is a problem, making sure that everything is documented and everything's done right, so that that database is something that all of us can use.
I'm talking with Chris Kolb, who's the president of the Michigan Environmental Council. You mentioned water as a theme this year, but the Michigan Environmental Council focuses on several key areas related to environmental stewardship, ecosystem sustainability. Tell our listeners who may not be familiar with your work a little bit about it, what it is that you folks do.
And the Michigan Environmental Council was created 36 years ago by several environmental organizations to really be the collective voice of the environmental community in Lansing, to focus on statewide environmental policies. And for 36 years, that's been our job. And there isn't a single area of environmental policy that we don't have some sort of say in and we work on. So we work both, you know, on air, water, land, transportation, energy, environmental health issues, agriculture, you name it. If it has an environmental impact, we're on the scene, and we really are focused in on, you know, working with key decision makers and bringing, you know, really good information to them, being at the table so when legislation is crafted that our voice is being heard and that they have to respond to us. And we've been doing a great job that way for, you know, as I said, 36 years, and I couldn't be prouder of an organization to be a part of.
Well, Chris, we've had the pleasure of having several of your staff on the program over the last 7 years. It's really great to finally have the president of the organization on. But congratulations on the award ceremony. Congratulations on the success of the Michigan Environmental Council. And thank you so much for your hospitality this evening.
Hey, we're glad you could be here, and I hope you're able to enjoy the party.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, our next guest is the recipient of the Michigan Environmental Council's Petoskey Prize for Environmental Leadership. She is Pam Taylor. Pam is a full-time volunteer for the Environmentally Concerned Citizens of South Central Michigan. She's an ardent champion of not only the Great Lakes, but all of our waterways, and also a passionate foe of large, confined animal feeding operations. Pam, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the microphone.
Thank you very much. This is a great honor for me.
Yeah, congratulations on the Petoskey Award from the Michigan Environmental Council. I mean, what a nice recognition for the hard work that you've done.
I'm just overwhelmed. This is an incredible honor, and most of the time we're out climbing around in ditches by ourselves, and it's kind of nice to surface every once in a while and see that people are aware of what we're doing.
Well, a lot of folks may know a bit about the Michigan Environmental Council, but some of our listeners may not know much about the Environmentally Concerned Citizens of South Central Michigan. Tell us about your work.
Environmentally Concerned Citizens of South Central Michigan, or ECCSCM, is a true grassroots organization. It was started back in the early 2000s by a few area residents who lived around Hudson, Michigan, and who became concerned about these large concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, or factory farms, whatever you want to call them, locating in that area. And we've evolved to the point where we've developed a water monitoring protocol that we use around fields where manure is applied or around the farms themselves. And we currently are monitoring 47 different locations in 20 different townships for pollutants that can come from factory farms.
Now, those pollutants include phosphorus and nitrogen, a lot of the things that have been responsible for those algal blooms in Lake Erie.
Exactly. Nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, ammonia, and also E. coli bacteria, but it just so happens that the thing that impacts Lake Erie the most is phosphorus, and it's a small portion of that phosphorus, dissolved phosphorus, that's really the culprit, and that's what we are trying to focus on right now.
Now, you know the arguments. I mean, you have an agricultural background. I have an agricultural background. A lot of producers say we do things right. We inject. We have slurry systems and what have you. One of your points, based on your research, is that no matter what practices they use, if they don't have the infrastructure to manage this manure, some of it's going to leach.
And that's exactly right. You can use whatever model you want to calculate how much phosphorus is actually getting into the water. But when you actually go out there with a little bottle and you capture the sample of what's coming out from the tile, sometimes it tells a different story. And the other thing that we're dealing with is when you're talking about animals, they continue to excrete no matter what. And it doesn't matter if equipment's broken down or if weather's bad or if you have to, you know, you have to make other arrangements. If you're a farmer, they have to deal with that manure. And sometimes, even under the best of intentions, things go wrong, and that's when we usually see the problems.
Now, under some of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative money and other grants and some federal programs, there have been some instances where municipalities and agricultural interests, golf course interests, are beginning to sit down and talk to each other. I know some of that's happened in Michigan. What needs to happen for those groups getting together? I mean, what are the next steps?
Well, you probably, if you've read anything about my group, you know that we really are promoting the impaired designation, because one of the things that starts that process or gets it going is an identification of sources and amounts. So we're not saying it's all golf courses or it's all factory farms, or you actually go up into the tributaries and you identify where it's coming from and how much, and then you sit down and you work and you make up a plan. You set a limit and you say, okay, you can't go beyond this. And that's the important part of that.
And you see, I mean, has progress been made in that respect? I know you don't like to talk about, well, it's Ohio's problem or it's Indiana's problem. Michigan's doing a little bit better. It's really a multi-state regional problem.
Right. The watershed knows no boundaries, and that was one of the important parts of our Follow the Manure mapping project. We chose to map that by watershed so you could see exactly where the loads were coming from. And that's really the key, is to look at the watershed, the loads, identify the sources and amounts, make a plan, make some accountability, and let people go from there and decide how they need to meet these limits.
My guest is Pam Taylor. She's a full-time volunteer for the Environmentally Concerned Citizens of South Central Michigan, and she's also the recipient of the Petoskey Award for Environmental Leadership from the Michigan Environmental Council. You have a lot of people talk about the problem and the cause of the problems. You have some specific solutions that your research has pointed to with respect to what these large animal operations can do to mitigate the problem.
Well, it depends on how far you want to take this approach. If you want to do an incremental approach, there are some things that could be done right away, like stop applying manure on snow and frozen ground, make sure you're not applying more manure than the crop can handle, because the current CAFO permit in Michigan allows that to be done. Make sure that you're using actual accountability measures like edge of field testing to make sure that the subsidy money is actually getting results that the taxpayers want to see. There's a whole list of things that you could do. But in the bigger sense, after seeing all the new techniques coming down and being tried in our area, I think someday we have to look at making factory farms get municipal-grade wastewater treatment systems. One cow produces the waste equivalent to 20 people every day, and if you have a 3,000-cow dairy, that's 60,000 people every day. And when you crowd several facilities like that into an area, it's just too much.
And then that municipal grade obviously would entail a great deal of expense. Would that somehow be some combination of the producer building that type of a facility with some state and federal support? How do you envision that being funded?
Well, I'm going to leave that one up to the politicians. I'm not at that pay grade where I can make those decisions. And if I say don't support the farmers to do that, some people will be upset. And if I say support them, then others will be upset. So I think I'll leave that up to the system. But I just know that it has to be done.
Now, in the meantime, yourself and several other volunteers will continue to monitor this discharge and this nutrient loading and continue to try and get action from our policymakers.
That's exactly right, and we know this is going to be a long battle. The war against slavery started somewhere. If you look at all the major civil rights issues, if you look at the war against tobacco, climate change issues that are happening right now, sometimes it takes a long time. And we know that this is going to be a long effort, but we have to start somewhere, and that's what we're doing.
And I think, I alluded to it earlier, but I think it's important for our listeners to know that you come to this whole issue of CAFOs and nutrient loading and what have you from a very strong agricultural background in your own family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. My family came to Lenawee County to farm in 1837, and members of my farm, although I don't farm anymore, members of my farm have been farming there since. So my brother who's here tonight and my parents and I still own a farm there.
1837, if memory serves me, that's the same year that Michigan became a state?
That's correct.
Well, that is certainly, and now you're here at the Michigan Environmental Council annual gathering. What does it mean to you personally to receive this award?
It just really has not sunk in yet. I just cannot express how grateful I am that our work is recognized. This is an incredible honor, probably one of the biggest honors of my life. For a little farm girl from South Central Michigan, this is a big deal.
Well, the Michigan environment, I mean, tonight, Dr. Mona and you are both here. They see you both as environmental champions. I want to congratulate you again. My guest has been Pam Taylor. She's a full-time volunteer for the Environmentally Concerned Citizens of South Central Michigan, and she is the recipient of the Petoskey Award from the Michigan Environmental Council. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, my next guest is Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, better known among many, many people across the United States as Dr. Mona. She's the director of the Michigan State University and Hurley Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative, and she also serves as director of the Pediatric Residency Program at Flint's Hurley Medical Center. For her commitment to children's health and her extraordinary efforts with respect to disclosure and acknowledgement of the Flint water crisis, she has been named one of Time Magazine's 2016 100 Most Influential People in the World. Mona, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you on the program.
Kirk, it's great to be here. Thank you.
The Flint crisis, among other things, really drew attention to this inextricable link between human health and environmental health, something I'm sure you've been aware of, particularly in your work with children. But speak to our listeners a little bit about that link.
Yeah, absolutely. So the work, what we do in the environment, the protections we have in place for the environment to ensure clean water, to ensure clean air, all these things, the main purpose primarily is to keep people safe and healthy. We cannot prosper as a community without having healthy air to breathe and healthy drinking, you know, water to drink. And I think, you know, I used to take it for granted that the water that you turn on your tap comes out and it's safe, just like almost everybody in this nation took for granted. We expected that there was people in white coats and test tubes going around and testing your water and making sure that they not only comply with certain guidelines, but exceed those guidelines and recommendations. So there is a direct connection to what happens in our environment and what happens in the health of our community. And most importantly, the people who are most vulnerable to environmental health issues are our children, and not just all of our children. It's specifically our children in our low-income, underserved, predominantly minority children. And this is the whole field of environmental injustice. And this is what we saw in Flint. This was a poor community, predominantly children who were impacted most by this environmental injustice.
This whole arena, 5 years ago, you wouldn't have heard terms like environmental justice, particularly when it came to poorer cities and what have you. But, boy, that has really emerged. And, unfortunately, situations like Flint have underscored the importance of addressing that issue. Environmental justice, how's it going in Flint since things blew up, I guess, in Flint with the water crisis?
Yeah, so, I mean, let me get back to the term environmental injustice or environmental justice, and some people go as far as calling it environmental racism. So one of the previous Millikan awardees who's actually going to be here today is Professor Bunyan Bryant from University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. And 20 years ago, he was a pioneer in this field. And when I was at University of Michigan School of Natural Resources, he taught me what environmental justice was 20 years ago. So this is not a new field. This is something that people have been dealing with in impoverished communities, from southwest Detroit to Flint to many communities throughout the nation for really decades. And it's great that the issue of Flint has brought this back into the limelight, because it needs to be brought into this limelight, because it's not an issue that we have resolved. In terms of the work that we are doing in Flint, it's progressing. Flint is kind of waning from the media, so we don't hear as much about the Flint water crisis, but we are very much definitely in the middle of a crisis. We are on our third year with water that we cannot drink. My kids in my clinic, they cannot turn on the water and drink from it. It needs to be filtered, or they need to use bottled water. So our water is yet to be safe. We've made tremendous advancements and investments in what we need to do for our children in regards to their health, their nutrition, their education. But many of these investments have only been short-sighted and not recognizing that this is a long-term problem. This is something we may have to deal with for decades to really generations when you consider what lead exposure does to children. And we have yet to garner those resources for our long-term recovery.
Dr. Mona, one of the questions we hear a lot about Flint and the aftermath, there are so many agencies, there are so many folks that are contributing, people that want to do good things for the city of Flint. But the coordination of all these different agencies, making sure that all the horses are pulling in the same direction, I would imagine that is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of the beauty of having the federal emergency. So when we got elevated to a federal emergency, with that came an operating center whose main job was to coordinate all this work. And it almost was an alphabet soup of agencies in Flint. We had the CDC and the EPA and SAMHSA and ATDSDR, NCEH. I mean, it really was an alphabet soup of folks. And then the state folks and the local folks trying to coordinate the emergency response. And that's kind of quieting down a little bit, that federal emergency and that coordination, and it's going a little better, but there's still a lot of coordination that is ongoing in terms of our long-term recovery.
Something that you're directly involved in, I mentioned it in my introduction, is called the Pediatric Public Health Initiative. For our listeners who may not be familiar with that, what is the Pediatric Public Health Initiative, and what are some of the things that you're doing as we speak?
Absolutely. So we're really excited about this. This is the partnership between Michigan State University and Hurley Children's Hospital. So both institutions have been in Flint for over 100 years, and this is our recommitment to the kids. This is recommitment to the community, our commitment to really flipping the story in Flint, working with our many partners, our many nonprofits, working with government, working with foundations, working with everybody to ensure that we are not going to be defined by this crisis, but rather we are going to be defined by our response to this crisis. And that's what this initiative is trying to do. It's trying to implement and advocate for interventions to promote our children's development. Things like universal preschool, which we're going to have in the fall for four-year-olds. Things like quality childcare, access to nutrition, healthcare access, transportation things. So these are all the things that we're trying to wrap around for our children to limit the impact of this exposure. And it really is the whole community working together to do this.
One of the positive outcomes, as I read things about this initiative, and we can talk about positive outcomes from Flint, you get around an awful lot. You're traveling all over the country, all over the world. People are reading about Flint. They're seeing some of these problems in their own communities. It seems to me there's a ripple effect looking at some of these problems around the country.
Absolutely. We have unleashed a storm. So there's definitely silver linings in our story. People are now talking about lead. We thought lead was a problem of yesterday. We thought we took care of lead. We did not take care of lead. It's a problem of yesterday, today, and tomorrow when you understand the consequences. We're talking about lead in water. Cities all over the nation are discovering lead in water issues, from Newark, New Jersey, Sebring, Ohio, Portland, Oregon. All over the nation, people are discovering lead in water. that was hidden or that was not tested. And so that's heightening the national awareness. People are talking about democracy and the lack of democracy. People are talking about environmental justice. People are talking about public health. People are talking about children and the development of children and the need to invest in our children. So it is amazing and incredible that we are spurring this national conversation. And I hope it becomes more than a conversation. I hope it moves to legislation and to resources to fund some of these initiatives so that we do not see another Flint, because we cannot. We had a similar lead and water crisis in D.C. about a decade ago. There never should have been a Flint. And we are committed to making sure that we learn from our mistakes and make sure this doesn't happen again.
As you know, a few years ago, President Obama put together a task force of mayors because of Great Lakes issues, and they are myriad. But do you see something at the presidential level? I mean, maybe not during conventions and elections, but perhaps in the aftermath of those, something in terms of this initiative that you were just talking about?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely been conversations at the federal level. Both Democratic candidates and Hillary Clinton obviously has been talking about Flint for quite some time. She was one of the early people supporting our work. The Democratic debates were held in Flint, and she said she was committed to working on Flint issues when she's in office. The EPA federally is also talking about things that they need to be doing. The lead and copper rule, which is part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is at the crux of this, needs to be revised. All of our federal rules in regards to lead in paint, lead in soil, lead in dust, lead in water need to be revised because they do not follow the science. Science tells us now that there is no safe level of lead, but all of these rules and all these guidelines do not fully protect children. So there is a lot of work happening at the federal level, but I think they do definitely need to be continued to be pushed.
Dr. Mona, we could talk at length about all of these issues and many more, but as we conclude, what's one thing you would like our listeners to know about the resiliency of Flint and ways that they might even be able to help at this stage?
Yeah, so Flint is an incredible place with incredible people, and this honor that I'm receiving today, I'm accepting it on behalf of my kids in Flint. They are beautiful, they are smart, they are strong, and they are incredibly resilient, and we are looking forward to proving to the nation that we are not only going to recover, but we are going to thrive after this crisis. And we are grateful for the support of really the whole nation during this water crisis. We definitely don't need any more water bottles. We have enough water, and that's something actually the federal government is paying for in the state government. But if people want to help, I encourage you to go to flintkids.org. Flintkids.org. It's the Flint Child Health and Development Fund, where we will be funding a lot of the programs to really promote our children's development.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I've been talking with Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, better known as Dr. Mona. If anybody embodies the spirit of Michigan State University and Spartans will, it's you, Mona. Thanks so much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
What better way to conclude this week's program, recorded on site at the Michigan Environmental Council's 18th Annual Environmental Awards presentation, than to welcome back to the show frequent guest, James Clift. James is the policy director of the Michigan Environmental Council. We're going to discuss a few issues of immediate concern. James, always great to see you, and what a festive occasion.
We always love this occasion, a chance for us to celebrate what we've done for the year. And I am the one person who's been to all 18 events.
Well, let's get right to it, though. The issues never rest, do they, even on occasions like this? The one I have to ask you about is the one that's been much in the news, the appointment of Heidi Grather as the new head of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, to say the least, has been met with mixed reviews.
That's clearly the case. You know, after Flint, we were hoping for somebody that maybe had a little bit more of a public health background, maybe see a little bit of a change of direction from the department. So we were a little disappointed on that hand. We have worked with Heidi in the past, and we're going to judge this administration by what they do, not who they appoint. So we're going to be watching carefully, because we are still hoping that we're going to see out of this department a little bit more focus on protecting public health and that being their primary mission, and maybe not so much worrying about being business friendly and making sure that they're taken care of, but making sure their first priority, protecting Michigan residents.
Yeah, particularly in the wake of the whole Flint debacle and what have you, public health has become front and center. A little bit about this interface between public health and environmental issues.
Yeah, there's always been kind of a disconnect in state government where you've got this division over here looking at public health in a very traditional public health way of looking at it. They're tracking the data long term, looking at these trends, where the Department of Environmental Quality and actually many other state agencies are making decisions all the time that have that direct impact on public health. Drinking water you couldn't get any more direct. And, of course, the Clean Air Act program at the Department of Environmental Quality. And then you think about the ties. We've got above average asthma rates in the state of Michigan. How much should the air division of the DEQ be working very closely with our public health agencies to figure out where can we make improvements? We've had a couple of areas recently where we've fallen into non-compliance with the Clean Air Act, mainly because of coal-fired power plants up in St. Clair County and Wayne County, Michigan. So we need to work better together to make sure that we're addressing these issues in a holistic manner.
And you mentioned a little earlier before we started this interview that you've worked with Heidi over the years, but you're not quite sure about her background specifically with respect to public health.
Yeah, again, she's been very involved in the cleanup of the oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico for the last decade, you know. So she's got some experience in that area. Clearly people look at her employer and focus on that. We've worked with her a little bit at the Michigan Agency for Energy, and we've been working well with her there and looking at the implementation of the Clean Power Plan in Michigan to reduce carbon. So, again, we've got a relationship with her. We're working with her, and we hope it's going to be a productive relationship moving forward.
Well, James, nice segue into my next question because you mentioned BP down in the Gulf, but let's talk about Enbridge and the progress that's being made on the assessment of Enbridge Line Number 5, which has been so much in the news and so controversial.
Yeah, again, we were a little disappointed with the settlement in Kalamazoo there. We think that those numbers are a little low as far as, you know, what is the real natural resource damages that were occurred on the Kalamazoo River? Largest inland oil spill ever. Clearly, this is something that cost $1 billion to clean up. There is still oil residue there. So our question is was that enough money? We don't think so. And what's going to happen to that money? How much of that money is going to get dumped back into the river to address some of the other challenges that they face due to legacy contamination that's there from industry from years ago?
So we still have the Kalamazoo River ongoing. What about up in the Straits of Mackinac? And a couple of firms have been retained now. Enbridge is going to pay over $3 million or at least up to, what, $3.65 to pay for these studies. What's your take and what's the council's take on that progress?
Yeah, again, we think that those are reports that needed to be done. Are there alternatives to that pipeline being in the Straits? We think there are, so it'll be good to get an official report. What is the worst-case scenario? We need to know that because that's when you determine, is it reasonable to spend X number of dollars? Well, we need to know what's at risk. And we know what's at risk. It's the Great Lakes. So we're looking at that, and we think that progress is going well. We've got some concerns in that we've alleged that they're currently in violation of the current easement. And we don't think state government is digging in enough on those current violations of the easement. Because if they're in violation of the easement, the state's got to call them on it. And if that's the case and they're violating it and they can't fix it, then we need to renegotiate that agreement. An agreement that I think the state got a whole $2,400 for that easement back in 1953, and that's the only payment the state's ever received. So I think it's an agreement that could be negotiated on much better terms. And the question is if someone came today and said, we'd like to put a pipeline through the Straits of Mackinac, I think we all would have the same answer. You know, heck no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and that easement investigation, as I understand it, that would be some combination of the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Natural Resources?
Yeah, that would be correct. That both of those agencies, we think we should be involved. We've spoken to the Attorney General's Office. We've asked them to dig in very closely on those easement violations and see it as a separate track than the reports currently being done by the state.
My guest is James Clift. He's the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. James, let's switch to a couple pieces of legislation that you've been closely tracking and have commented on publicly. Those are Senate bills 437 and 438 that, according to the Michigan Environmental Council, will end up, if they're passed, costing businesses and homeowners a lot of money.
Yeah, we're looking at a $4 billion price tag over the next 10 years if that legislation passes as is. And we just think that they have gone down the wrong track with that legislation. Since 2008, we've had a very successful implementation of a clean energy legislation that was moving us down the right road, getting renewable energy up to 10%. We're creating businesses in Michigan, creating economic development in Michigan that we didn't have, and if we wouldn't have had during the economic downturn, would have been in trouble. So we think, hey, let's just continue down that path, slowly transition in more renewable energy, more energy efficiency, and make good decisions so that we have both healthy utilities and healthy economic development. But if you raise these costs on business, we're going to hurt businesses, especially they're asking more and more. We want green energy. That's why they're going to come to Michigan. We need to give them what they want.
Well, you made a good case in other organizations about the positive economic impact of the 10% renewable portfolio standard. So this is not a business versus environment decision. I mean, this renewable energy is a win-win.
Yeah, we've got businesses across the state supporting us, and large organizations, Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce, very dissatisfied with these bills as written, and they're partnering with us to try to improve them.
So at this point, I know it's early, but what's your best guess? Are these bills dead on arrival, or may we be facing a problem?
I think we're going to be seeing more discussion. I expect that it's not going to happen before the election, that this might be a lame duck session to piece of legislation that we're going to be looking at.
Let's go back to Flint for a minute. There's some funding and that's been recommended for lead poisoning prevention programs. A lot of people think that the funding the subcommittee has proposed is far less than adequate. Your take on that?
Yeah, they're kind of going with the status quo funding from last year, where we thought, hey, post-Flint, we have recognized a very large problem in the state, and we know that every dollar we spend on lead prevention, lead abatement, that there's many more dollars we're going to save down the road in reduced education costs, potentially corrections costs for those kids that are lead exposed. So that's good money. We think that number needs to be increased. I believe it's just below $2 million. We're looking at almost $7 million we think needs to go into that program.
James, for our listeners who are interested in these issues and many others, they can follow those issues on your website. Where's the best place to go?
Yeah, so environmentalcouncil.org is where you find us and the work we're doing, and we love everyone's support.
It's always a pleasure talking with James Clift. He's the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. We celebrate tonight, James, but back to work in Lansing tomorrow.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
Salagadoola, metricaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi. Together, and what have you got?
WKAR.
MSU alumnus Peter Carey plays legendary Detroit Tigers broadcaster and iconic Michigander Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie, now the longest-running play in Detroit theater history. Peter will be playing Ernie at his alma mater when the play comes to MSU's Wharton Center
August 24th through the 27th.
Peter, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir.
For the few out there who don't know, and I'm not sure if plot is the right word, but tell us about Ernie.
Well, Mitch did a wonderful job writing it. It's
when you're dealing with such an iconic figure such as Ernie Harwell, so beloved and has so many stories in his repertoire, how do you do it? Well, he designed it and wrote it so that it's 9 innings of Ernie's life. And it takes place on his farewell speech, on the night of his farewell speech at Comerica Park in 2009, when he said thank you very much to everybody. And so it's that evening, he's getting ready for his farewell speech, and then all of a sudden this mystical, mysterious boy shows up, and that's his title, Boy. And he coaxes Ernie into telling him his life's broadcast. And you sit there, you go, what? Well, he coaches him and cajoles him into 9 innings of from when Ernie's 8 years old through his childhood, how he got started in broadcasting, and ending up on stage with his final farewell speech.
And what attracted you to this role?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've always been an Ernie Harwell fan. And a friend of mine, an actor friend who's an attorney, was doing the legal work for the play, and he called me up and said, hey, they're looking for an understudy. And he goes, and I know you love Ernie and you can sound like him. And so I went in and read a couple of little paragraphs of copy and of script, and they said, oh, yeah, great. Well, then I get the script, and it's 60-plus pages, and I go, wait a minute. I haven't memorized this much stuff in a long time, so it was a big challenge.
Yeah, can you give me the ear for this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And Peter, I'm wondering, what are the challenges of playing such an iconic figure as Ernie Harwell, whom so many of us love and are so familiar with, as opposed to playing a fictional character?
Well, that's an excellent question, because Ernie is so loved, you have to respect the man. In some people's minds, the myth, the legend, but you don't do an impersonation of him. You don't do a caricature of him. You channel Ernie Harwell, and if you're true to his belief and how he lived his life, it comes through on stage, and people love it. So you can't make fun of it. You have to be honest, and there are aficionados out there that show up and go, wait a minute. Those shoes aren't right. He would never have tassels on his shoes, and so you change the wardrobe. But we have Ernie's glasses and his iconic Greek fisherman's cap, and it's fun.
And since you've got your own lifelong relationship with Ernie, is there a part of the play that's particularly meaningful to you?
The whole thing is incredible, but I get a special, call it a tingle, because that's Ernie's word, when I talk about seeing, there's a scene where Ernie talks about his first ballpark, and he says, every kid remembers his first ballpark, no matter how old he gets. And then he visualizes his first ballpark. Well, my first ballpark was Tiger Stadium as a kid, and it was Ernie Harwell on the radio, you know, listening to 760.
And you know, Peter, you're engrossed in playing the character, obviously, but have you been able to notice some of the audience reactions? And again, for such a beloved figure, that must be heartwarming as well.
You do feed off the energy of the audience. That's one of the great things about live theater. There's this exchange between actor on stage and audience, even though there's the proverbial fourth wall. It's funny because you have these women that have these big, burly baseball fan husbands weeping on their shoulder, and they're patting them going, it's all right, honey, it's all right, because it's a very emotional play.
Is there something you've learned about Ernie that maybe we didn't know that you could share with us?
I knew he was loved by the public, and that everybody like myself probably had Ernie Harwell stories. But the magnitude of the people this man touched is phenomenal. People come up. I had a lady Sunday night after the show wait around to talk to me, and she goes, I have seen this play 7 times. And she started to tell me a couple of her Ernie Harwell stories, when he came to her church, when he came to another women's function that she was at. You don't understand the magnitude of his reach until you interact with all these people.
Peter Carey is my guest. He's playing Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie, coming to MSU's Wharton Center August 24 to 27. What about working with the genius that is Mitch Albom?
Oh, he's wonderful to work with because not only does he respect you as an actor, he gives you permission to try things with his content. And it's a mutual collaboration of, okay, let's try this, and then, wow, that works, or, well, not really. So that's the great thing about it. You work through it, and you make it better. And if he sees something that has changed, this is our fifth year, and he made some tweaks this year to lines and things. He said, yeah, let's try this.
And, Peter, I mentioned at the top of our conversation that you're an MSU alumnus. Will it be kind of special to play Ernie at your alma mater?
That's an understatement. Oh, my gosh. Now, I don't want to date myself, but back in the 70s, there was no Wharton Center. But it's funny, when I was understudy for Ernie, the young gentleman who played the boy understudy is an MSU theater alumni. He's a theater grad here, and he's telling me all about the wonderful stuff that has taken place. And of course, I continue to visit the campus all the time, and I love what's happened. And Wharton Center, I've seen several productions there. It's a beautiful facility, and I can't believe that I am coming back and I'm going to grace that stage. That's an honor.
And can you tell me a little bit more about your path to MSU back in the 70s and how has this place impacted you, and maybe how it still impacts you?
Well, I'm green and white. And my oldest daughter, she's also in the alumni fold here at MSU. I was here from 74 to 78 and then actually stayed an extra year to do radio because I was at a local commercial station. And something happened in 1979. We won some basketball championship, and I remember standing out in front of Dooley's, and we were celebrating, and I said, oh, my gosh, I have to go to work. So I think I left the celebration at 5:30 and went on the air at 6 o'clock, and the celebration continued. But I was in a production class. Actually, it wasn't even a production class then. I have to go back further. MSU has had a huge impact on me, but more so, some of the alumni have. Scott Westerman, Steve Schramm have gone on to great careers, and they started me on my career path, and I'm thankful for them. I was sitting in a psychology class, and Scott Westerman said, hey, you know, you got a nice voice. You want to try radio? Well, he kept on me, and lo and behold, my career path changed from pre-med to the entertainment world.
Well, Peter, you are one of the most successful voiceover and film talents really in Detroit history. I can say that. You don't have to. And you, like you said, you were a DJ on the radio for many years. I'm curious how, with iPods and Pandora and all things like that, how you think the industry has changed most over the years and where you see it headed.
Wow.
I know we could have a 3-day conference.
I was
going to
say
that,
but this is more like a weekend conference, but the technology has progressed so much in the last 10 years compared to the 30 years prior, and the rapid pace keeps increasing. You can carry a studio, a full recording studio, digital, unlimited tracks, on your laptop or your iPad now, and I can do it. I can record on the road. When I'm on a live tour, somebody will say, well, we've got an audition for you. Can you go to your hotel room and do that? Before, you'd have to find a studio, and there'd be tape, and there'd be editing, and now you can do that all on even your phone. It's scary. Wonderfully scary, but guess what? They might not need actors soon. We'll all be digital.
And I know, Peter Carey, you benefited from and were a big fan of the film incentives that have sadly gone away. Just any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't want to get too political about it, but you look at places that have embraced it, like Georgia, they're building 17 new sound studios and they can't hire people enough. I know a lot of my really good friends in the industry, crew, gaffers, grips, sound people, cameramen, they're heading down there because they pulled the plug here. So it's sad, but the diehards that have been waving the flag for a long time, myself one of them, we love Michigan, and we want to see it prosper, and so that hurts.
What about with all we've talked about acting and performing on and digital media? What's your advice to the young Spartans or any young people looking to get into this kind of field today?
Excellent question again. Don't give up. You have to, we joke about it, but you have to thrive on rejection. Let's put a little baseball in it here. If you're batting 200 in your auditions in the performance world, you're doing great. I think I get one out of tens of handfuls of auditions that I go on. But when you get them, there's an incredible reward. Don't limit yourself. If you have an opportunity to try something else, do it. Get out of your comfort zone. It sounds cliche, but that's where you find your self-discovery, is when you expand your comfort zone. And next thing you know, it's on your resume and you can say, yeah, I can do that.
I'm talking with Peter Carey, who's Ernie in Mitch Albom's Ernie Harwell. And as we close, Peter, can you maybe give us a favorite line or two as Ernie?
Well, it's wonderful. There are standard Ernie calls that people adore, and they actually cheer when we do them in the play. Ernie is about to sneak out, and the boy doesn't want to let him go yet. And he goes, please, please, do some of your calls. And so Ernie goes, grounded a trammel over to Whitaker to Evans. That's two for the price of one. Strike three looking. He's called out for excessive window shopping. So we have a lot of fun. And then his iconic verse as he started spring training down in Florida. For lo, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds has come. And the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to spring training.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Peter Carey is Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie, coming back to MSU's Wharton Center August 24th through the 27th. There's more information at whartoncenter.com. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
WKAR. For listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.